good afternoon. We have a full agenda. We'll see how far we get with it, but we have a full agenda, in theory. We have a medrash to look at, and then if we manage to get through that, I was going to do a little bit about the Haggadah, and one particular passage of Midrash that's in the Haggadah that requires some explanation. So you have the sheets for it, and if we get to it, we get to it, and if not, well, I'll just remain perplexed for another year. But
maybe you should do that.
We started this Midrash last time, and there's a rule which is set out in the Talmud. It goes in the original Tadir v'she'eino Tadir Tadir Kodein, which means that which is more frequent has priority. So, for example, in context in the Talmud, they're talking about offerings brought in the temple in the Beis Hamikdash, and they say that the daily offering precedes special offerings because it's there every day. Therefore, you put it first. So, our normal topic, our regular topic, is the set of midrash about Noah. So that's what we'll start with. And if we get through it, then we can do the other things. Which may be an appropriate application of Tadir, and it may not, but that's beyond the scope of where we're going to go right now. Our midrash that we're looking at, which we started to look at a little bit at the end last week, is the midrash of the illumination of the boat, the ark, Noah's Teva. And specifically, the identity of the Tzohar that Noah uses. So we saw already source number one, which is the instruction that God gives to Noah to make a Tzohar for the boat. And that is his full description of what this Tzohar is supposed to be. We also saw two other verses. We saw source number two, in which we are told that Noah has a window on the boat, which he opens to let out the birds when he wants to see whether there's dry land. And then, in source number three, we saw a statement that God makes after the flood, in which he declares that for the rest of the days of the land, planting, harvest, cold, heat, summer, winter, day and night shall not cease. And discussed a little bit about some of the terms in that sentence last time. But those three sentences are very important in order to understand the Midrash that we're going to see today. So keep those sentences in mind, even though the connection between them may not be so clear at the moment. God willing, an hour from now you'll say, oh, of course. If not, you get a refund. The other important information which we saw last time had to do with the word Tzohar itself. And you see it in source number four. The word Tzohar is associated with two other biblical words directly. One is Tzoharayim, which is the middle of the day. And the other is Yitzhar, which is olive oil, which is used for lamps, for illumination. And so we understand that the word Tzohar is somehow associated with light.
Illumination.
As a matter of fact, how do you say in modern Hebrew a speech which one delivers to set out an idea? Modern Hebrew. I don't know when this word came into the language, how old it is, but I believe we call it a hartza'a is one of them, but also isn't there also hatzhara?
A
declaration. Right? When you set something out, I wonder if that's also connected to this idea that tzadi hei resh as a root is to illuminate. So there it's a declaration. I wonder if there's an association. But we noted that, as well as potentially within Aramaic, tzadi in the Hebrew word may switch with a tet in Aramaic, so I noted the word tihara, which is the term for a period of daylight, and then the word tahara, purity, which ritual purity, which may well be associated with this illumination as well. That may be a reach, I'm not sure. But in any case, the point is that the word Tzohar is associated with illumination. So God is telling Noah, make illumination for the boat. Well, that's a fascinating thing, because I don't know how Noah is going to make illumination for anything. One thing we do know is he's not lighting a fire. Because fire on a boat, especially a boat made of gopher wood, is not a good idea. So, that's out. So then, what is this illumination that Noah is going to make on his boat? And that's where our Midrash comes in. And that's source number five. Tzohar ta'aseh la'teva. You shall make a tzohar for the boat. Rabbi Chunya, Rabbi Pinchas, Rabbi Chanin, Rabbi Hoshaya, lo mefarshin. These four sages we just listed, Rabbi Chunya, Rabbi Pinchas, Rabbi Hanin, Rabbi Hoshea, they don't debate this point. We don't know what they said, although we're going to come back to what they said, but there's no disagreement between them. There is disagreement between Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana and Rabbi Levi. Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana and Rabbi Levi do indeed debate. Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana Amar Chalon. Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana says, well, if you ask me, what's Noah going to do to illuminate the boat? He makes a window. Now, in those days, you don't have a glass pane as a window. But what you could have is simply a section of the wood that you're able to pull out as needed to provide light. Maybe it's sheltered a little bit from rain or something, some kind of a structure in order to keep the rain from coming in. And that, theoretically, is what's meant by chalon here. So how would be a window in the boat. We do know that Noah has a window because we already saw that. One possibility. Rabbi Levi Omar, Margaliot. Rabbi Levi says, gems. These are gems that Zohar, that Noah has on the boat to provide illumination. That's a fascinating idea. How does a gem provide illumination? Yeah.
It's translucent.
Well, so where he gets the gems is probably something along the lines of where he gets the cobra and the elephant. Which is to say, somehow or other, Noach is a very resourceful person. He's given 120 years. The 120 years is a good length of time, you know, for you to go gem hunting. It's a good question, but the answer would be somehow he has the means. Regarding the animals, there is in the Midrash the idea, which we may get to one day, that depending on whether we continue this for the next several years, but there is the idea that the animals actually come to Noach, because the sages pick up on various words that are there, and the Torah they show the animals come to him, which makes life a lot easier. Gems can't walk, so I'm not sure how that works. But Noach is supposed to take these gems potentially, and someone mentioned gems are shiny. What's the problem with using the answer of gems are shiny to explain this? Right. You need light for them to reflect. Where is this light coming from? So the truth of the matter is, if you take a look at source number 6, there are at least 3 different sources for the light that you see from a gem. One is called dispersion. And I gave you links for each of these if you're interested in looking into this further. Dispersion is when a gem refracts different wavelengths of light by different amounts. Remember what refraction is as opposed to reflection. You have to remember back to like grade 5 or grade 6, so it's a long way back. But basically, the way that it works is, in reflection, so the light is simply bounced back. In refraction, the light, the different frequencies that are within the light, oh, perfect. Look at Ralph. There you go. Right? The stripes on Ralph's sweater are perfect for this. I've got my rainbow right here. The different wavelengths of light are going to pass through the material at different angles and are going to, in fact, be dispersed. That's what we call refraction. And so the idea here is, and I hope I'm getting that right scientifically, someone listening to the audio is going to email me angrily because he's a physicist and knows this a lot better than I do. But that's my basic recollection of how dispersion works. And the idea is that a gem will refract different wavelengths of light by different amounts so that some gems will actually have what's called a high dispersion rate and some gems will have a low dispersion rate. But that's number one. And the link I gave you there next to dispersion is a chart for how different gems disperse light. Second is what's called fluorescence. In fluorescence, you expose a gem to a particular wavelength of light, usually one of the shorter waves, and it causes the gem to actually produce light on another wavelength. And the best example of this is if you go into a gem room at a museum and you see that the room is dark, but the gems are all lit up, they're using ultraviolet light. Ultraviolet light is not visible to your eye. When it passes through the gem, the gem transforms it into visible light, so that the gem looks like it's producing light. And so it is possible for a gem to actually be seen to produce light if it has fluorescence. That, by the way, is, I think, Shana, what you were talking about before in terms of the luminescence in the Agatha Christie story that you're telling me about. Yes? Okay. That's second. Third is something called eventuarescence. Eventuarescence, which sounds a lot more exciting than the other two, doesn't it? There's no D, though. But eventuarescence is where the internal structure of the gem, based on the flaws within the gem itself, they may not be seen as flaws. It's like in computer programming where it's not a bug, it's a feature. So this isn't a flaw. This is actually a facet or a surface. But the internal structure of the gem will cause light to reflect, will cause light to be reflected and even to glitter in certain gems, depending on the internal structure. So there are three ways in which gems can be seen to produce light, at least to magnify it, but potentially even to actually look like it's producing light. So maybe this is what we're talking about, but we need to talk more about what a Tzohar is as a gem, and then we'll understand more. Because if Tzohar is a gem, we need to know which gem it is, and that will determine to what extent it's capable of dispersion, fluorescence, or eventuarescence.
Are you suggesting that Noah knew this stuff?
I am suggesting that there's a particular gem, which this Medrash believes Noah is using, which is capable of doing these things. Whether one knows the physics behind it, whether one knows the physics behind it or not, is not relevant. As long as you know
that a gem disperses light,
why not? I mean, the Greeks and Romans were capable of that. Why? It's observation. It's not scientific theory. You don't need to have any building block information about optics and the nature of light as a particle or a wave or anything else in order to be able to observe a particular stone and what it does when exposed to light. That would be the idea behind it. Now, maybe Noah knows more than that. I don't know. Those are some of the ways in which gems are seen to produce light. I have to continue in the Medrash still to go further with this, and we have to talk about what this Tzohar might have been. We ain't done yet. Rita.
So, Noah decided to use the gems to make light.
That's not what we said, right? We said that this was a divine command. Tzohar tasela teva. God says, take a Tzohar, which is a gem, according to this view.
Okay, thank you.
Correct. It's not an autonomous thing, no. So continuing in the Medrash, just to make sure that we actually read the text we're working from, Rabbi Pinchas Mishum Rabbi Levi Omar, Rabbi Pinchas, who we saw cited before as one of those who did not debate, he seems to agree with Rabbi Levi, who said that the Tzohar is a gem. We're back in source number 5 still. He said, Kol Yud Beis Chodesh Shehaya Noach Bateva, for all 12 months that Noach was in the boat, he didn't need sunlight by day. He did not need moonlight by night. He had a gem, and he suspended the gem inside the boat. When the gem was dim, he knew it was daytime outside. And when it shone, Haya Yodaya Shehu Laila. He then knew that it was night. That's a really interesting idea. Does that fit with anything? Any of our explanations about where gems get their light? This is a very hard idea. See, if you were to tell me that Noah is standing in the sunlight, and that when there's sunlight outside, the gem seems dimmer, that I would get. Because, like you're holding a candle outside in the daytime, so the candle doesn't seem to provide light. Whereas in the absence of other light, then it will become brighter. But our assumption here is that sunlight is not not an option, and he's simply using the gem. That's what Rabbi Levi has suggested, that he only has a gem in the boat, and that somehow it's dimmer by day and brighter by night. That question becomes more complicated by the last line in our Medrash. Amar Rabbi Huna said, Arikin Havinon Minkume Gunda. We were fleeing from soldiers. These are Roman soldiers that he's talking about when the Romans are trying to prevent them from transmitting Torah for fear that the Torah they're transmitting is going to fuel the Jewish rebellion against the Romans. So we were fleeing from soldiers, Bahada Botita de Tiberia, in a cave in Tiberias. Vahaya biyadeinu neros. We had lamps in our hands. We had lamps that we used for light. Not gems, but lamps. When the lamps were dim, we knew it was daytime. When they shone, we knew it was night. In other words, just like what happened for Noah on the boat. I am not clear on whether Rav Huna believes that this is a natural or supernatural phenomenon. You could read this line, I think, legitimately either way. You could read this as Rav Huna testifying and saying, yeah, just like they say happened for Noah, so too happened for us on the in our cave. I've seen it myself, how light gets dimmer during the day and brighter by night. That could be one explanation. Another explanation is that he believes what happened on the boat was supernatural. God did this so that Noah would know whether it was daytime or nighttime. And so too, God did this for us when we were in the cave, so that we would know whether it was daytime or nighttime. God was acting on our behalf in order to help us out. Do you have any sense of this, of what the whether this is being viewed as natural or supernatural?
I don't see any supernatural here. We're just talking about personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
And even when it's raining, there's a difference between daylight and darkness.
Even when it's raining, there is a difference between daylight and darkness. True, but if you're in a sealed boat, right, is there still a difference? I mean, this has to be pretty well sealed. Keep in mind,
true.
If this isn't waterproof, you're in trouble.
But he's got the carbuncle. He's got the stone set somewhere.
Right.
In the top of the boat.
So this is a very interesting question that Ralph raises. In my mind's eye, as a child in grade 2, hearing this story, I assumed that the gem was actually lodged, pretty much as Ralph just described it, somewhere towards the top of the boat, and in the boards, and therefore any light from outside would potentially come through the gem. However, I have two objections to that idea. Objection number one is the sealing you would have to do around the gem to withstand the pressure of the water, which, I mean, that's serious pressure. That's number one. And then number two, granted that we found ways to deal with all the other problems, yes, it's true, the boat comes towards a point towards the top, but that brings me to problem number two, which is we already know, because we read our verse, that this boat has three floors. What happens? Three floors. There's a lower level, right?
Floors.
Yeah. You have the lower level, you have the intermediate level, and the upper level. So, what happens for illumination then for the second and third level? In fact, our Medrash didn't say there was one gem. It said there were multiple gems. And indeed, you saw the line that said he had gems hanging in the boat. So, according to that, I'm back to square one. Shana.
I was going to say that Rav Huna is describing an event that took place within the ordinary operations of the natural world in the sense that there was the sun outside during the day. We don't know that's the case with Noah.
Correct. And we're going to come back to just how much we don't know about that. I suspect you're already going there. That is true. So it's possible that Rav Huna is describing a natural phenomenon, whereas for Noah and the boat, it's a supernatural phenomenon. Entirely possible. I think you can make that distinction. Let's talk a little bit about this gem in order to understand what may have been going on in daytime and nighttime, at least on the boat, if not in Rav Huna's cave. Flip the page, please. Rabbeinu Bachaye, commentary to Shmot, to Exodus, a passage that describes the gems that were on the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. We know that he wore a choshen, a breastplate that had 12 stones on it, representing the tribes of the Jewish people. And the Torah tells us the names of each of the gems. Now, of course, the Torah does not say diamond, sapphire, emerald, ruby, and so on. Instead, it gives us the names that the Torah will use for those gems, and we have to figure out what those gems would be parallel to in our day. But take a look at source number 7, where he comments on a gem that is identified as the third stone on the breastplate, and it is called in Hebrew bareket. Now, once I tell you bareket, Hebrew speakers are going to immediately say, what does bareket mean? That which shines. Correct, because the word for lightning in Hebrew is barak. So keep that in mind. Rabbeinu Bechaye, there are two Rabbeinu Bechayes, also known as Bachya. There is one who's the earlier one, Bachya ibn Pakuda, who wrote Chavot HaLevavot, Duties of the Heart. And then this is a later one, in his commentary on the Torah. But he says on the gem known as Bareket, V'hu ha karbunkla. Carbuncle. Ah, so this is the problem when you Google carbuncle, is that you find out that it's also a boil, which you don't want. You may want the one that's the gem, though. Shana, yes?
You have to read Sherlock Holmes. I'm telling you, this ingredient is indispensable. There's a story in Sherlock Holmes called the blue carbuncle. It's not about a boil.
Excellent. But yes, mystery reading, first of all, every medrash is a... I hope that if we've learned nothing else this year, it's that every medrash is a mystery waiting to be solved. But but in terms of the carbuncle, you now have your reading for Pesach, you have to read the blue carbuncle. Fine. The Vuhu HaCarbuncle. Nikres Barekes. It is called Bareket. Al Shem Shenotzetzet Kibarak Umiirak Kener. Because it shines like lightning. I added the word Barak there in parentheses. And it illuminates like a lamp. V'chein Targum Barkan. The Aramaic commentary to the Torah on the word Bareket says Barkan. Which is indeed that which shines. It's the shining one. V'hu Eben Shetala Noach Bateva. That is the stone that Noah hung in the boat. Mimasha kasub tzohar tasela teva. As the text says, you shall make a tzohar for the boats. Rabbeinu Bechaye says, it is a radiant gem known as a carbuncle. Now, if you actually were to Google carbuncle looking for the gem, you wouldn't find much. And the reason you wouldn't find much is because the gem has another name. It is not only known as a carbuncle, it is also known as a garnet.
Garnet.
G-A-R-N-E-T. That, I think, people have heard more about. Under the name garnet, it's better known. Pliny calls it a carbuncle, but it's also called a garnet.
That's an old word, an old English word. Shakespeare uses it.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Sorry?
Garnet shine.
Ah, so does a garnet shine? In fact, the garnet, we are told, is characterized by fire-like brilliance. As a matter of fact, that's where the name carbuncle comes from. Carbuncle is rooted in what Latin word? You know it as one of the elements?
Carbon.
Exactly. No, I'm not joking. That's where carbuncle, and that's why it's also a boil. Sorry?
That's for diamonds.
Also true, but think of carbuncle as a boil, and of course it makes sense. So take a look at source number 8 from the Natural History of Pliny. He's described Pliny.
Pliny.
When you met him, that was how he pronounced it.
That's what I was taught.
Sorry, that was a cheap shot. Source number 8. He's talking about gems, and he says, not unlike sardonyx too, is sarda, that's from the previous section there, he says, but before passing on to it, before going on to talk about sarda, he says, we must first take some note of all these precious stones which have a brilliancy like that of flame. And then he begins a new section. In that section he says, in the first rank among these is carbunculus, so called from its resemblance to fire. And then he talks about how there are two varieties of the gem. One is known as the male variety, and one is known as the female variety. And he says, in the male varieties, too, we see some in which the fire is clearer than in others, while some, again, are of a darker hue, or else have their brilliancy more deeply seated and shine with a more powerful luster than others when viewed in the sun. What's particularly interesting when you talk about garnet is, first of all, that most of them are not fluorescent. So they're not going to take this ultraviolet light or lower wavelength of light and then make it into a visible light. That you're not going to see with garnet. But on the other hand, something is happening with light in them in order to give it this fiery appearance. And there are varieties of garnet which change color in the sunlight. And so one wonders about the possibility of the recommendation to Noach, use garnet as your source of illumination. Whatever light it has is going to change its color and potentially give it some kind of glow that will make it usable as your source of light in the boat. Maybe. I think that for me, the study of the gems itself is worth it. I find this very interesting. But in terms of why God tells Noah to use this, and why Rabbi Levi thinks that it could be a gem, I think there's something to be said for this idea that has existed since a very long time ago. But here's the big question. The big question is not, what was it that Noah used? The question is, once again, as we've done since the beginning of the year, I want to know. The rabbis have this really fine ear for language, and that's what drives every comment you see in a medrash. There's something going on in the Torah's language that makes them say, there's something here to understand that isn't obvious in the text. Something touched off Rabbi Levi and made him say, this is a gem, not a window. It's not simply that Rabbi Levi woke up one morning and said, hey, wouldn't it be cool if Noach's Tzohar was actually a gem instead of a window? There's something in the text itself, or as I believe, some things in the text itself, that make Rabbi Levi say, this is a gemstone, not a window. What would that be? Whether from your ear for language or just logic, what would make you say that this should be a gem instead of a window? Shana, go ahead.
We have a word for window. It's right there a couple of verses later. So if it's a window in one place, why would it be? If it's a chalon in one place, why isn't it a chalon in the other place?
Excellent, and that was why I brought you source number two. Source number two, we read, Noah opened the window of the boat he had made, and the Torah calls it a chalon, which is the word that we normally use for a window. I've never heard anybody say, open the Tzohar. And the Tzohar is not used as a word for window throughout Tanakh. So I think that's one point, is Rabbi Levi has an ear for language, and he says, if Tzohar meant window, it would have said chalon. That's number one. Number two, what else is driving this? I'll take the easy one. It's raining outside, folks. It's dark. It's raining. You're not using a window for illumination, certainly if you don't have glass. You're going to keep that window good and shut, and there will be no light inside. So why would it even dawn on you to think that this would be a window? Rabbi Levi, I think from a logical perspective, is compelled to say this. I think that's another point. A third point, why else? Look back again at source number one and the verb that's used. Noach is told to do what?
To make a tzohar.
If it's a window, there's nothing for him to make. Carve out a piece of wood, right? From your walls of your boat, from these boards of gopher wood, and you're done. Making it suggests that he has to do something, introduce something. And so I suspect that the verb ta'aseh, that you shall make the tzohar, is part of this. And then there's one point that we haven't really addressed, although I think Shana was hinting to it a little while ago. And that's source number three. After the flood is over, we are told that God tells Noah and crew
that from the rest of the days of the land, planting and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter and day and night shall not cease.
Well, that's really interesting. Why does God need to say that after the flood?
Couldn't tell the difference.
Yeah. See, that makes a lot of sense in terms of the first part of the sentence. Right? There is no planting and harvest when the world is flooded. There is no cold and heat and summer and winter. There are no seasons. Right? Because the sun isn't visible. You've got clouds blocking it. Nothing is growing.
It's only 40 days.
No, it's not. It's a year. 40 days of rainfall. But then everything is submerged. You're right. There may not be clouds anymore. But everything is submerged. You're right. There may not be clouds at that point. But there's certainly no planting going on. But what's the deal with day and night? Why should we say that day and night will never cease? What happened to day and night during the flood? Flip your page to the back and source number 10, please. This is a mirror passage for our Medrash. Remember that we've seen over and over again this year. That's like the third time today that I've used that phrase. That's enough for that phrase. But we have seen that Medrash will appear in one body of Medrash and then in a slightly different version in another body of Medrash. And then another version in another body of Medrash. So here, this is the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, which is a long piece of which this is only a little bit of a selection, and appropriately enough, it's about Pesach. I'm trying to figure out whether I can ask this as a question or not. I think better not to, because I don't want to embarrass anyone. When I was growing up as a child, we used to search for chametz using a candle. Right? And at a certain point, we sort of grafted in using a flashlight. So that we now use a flashlight and a candle. Why in the world do we stick to the candle? And don't tell me tradition. What's this about a candle? Why not just use a flashlight? It's certainly safer as you walk around your house. It's certainly neater and cleaner. You do not need to worry about dripping wax. What's the deal with the insistence on a candle? So the Talmud has a discussion about why, in particular, a lamp should be used. Mind you, the Talmud is not necessarily talking about a wax candle. They can be using an oil lamp just as easily. But the point is a single filament flame in the Talmudic discussion, as opposed to an avuka, which is a multi-wick flame. And what one of the things the Talmud says is it quotes the verse, Ner Hashem Nishmat Adam. That the lamp of God is the soul of man, comparing the soul to a lamp. And then there's another verse about God, Achapes et Yerushalayim Banei Rot, God seeking through Jerusalem with lamps. And there are all sorts of links that the Talmud makes. But there's another idea that a lamp should be used in particular, and it should be done at night because the lamp will not provide the same illumination by day as it will by night. And that's where this passage in the Talmud comes into play. Source number 10. Afilu bayit sheyesh bo ora. Even a house that has light. Afilu bayom. Even by day. Tzarich livdok laor haner. You still have to check by the light of a lamp. I don't care if you have daylight, you need the light of the lamp. And whether it's because the light of the lamp is hinted at the Nair references that I just gave before, or whether it's because the light of the lamp will get into the corner because it's directed as opposed to the light of day, which may have shadows, whatever reason you want to give. I heard someone say the other day, I thought this was an interesting idea, that using a candlelight in particular forces you to pay attention. As opposed to if you're just using the general daylight, I thought that was an interesting comment. But we want you to use a lamp, and we want you to do it even if you're in a house that has daylight. Even in the event that you are searching by day, you have to use a lamp. And then they say the following. Kai demar Rabbi Achya bar Ze'ira. As Rabbi Achya bar Ze'ira said, Noach beknisa sola teva hechnis imo abanim tavos umargoliyos. When Noach entered the boat, he brought with him precious stones and gems. When they were dim, he knew it was day. And when they shone, he knew it was night. Right? Just like we saw in our Medrash. Slightly different wording, but the same idea. Lama, why? Why does Noah need to know whether it's day or night anyway? He ain't getting out of the boat any sooner. You know, imagine him sort of making marks on the inside of the boat, like one, two, three. Like, what's the point? And the answer here is, I think someone suggested it last time. For the animals, right? Yesh chaya ochelas b'yom, v'yesh chaya ochelas b'alayla. Because some animals eat during the day, and some animals eat during the night, and you need to feed them at the proper time. And poor Noach is going to be running himself ragged, because that's his mission for this year, for reasons we've discussed before, for reasons we'll add in future midrashim, God willing. But you have to know when it's day and when it's night. It's important. And therefore, whether it's a natural phenomenon or a supernatural phenomenon, God is going to make sure that Noach knows when it is day and when it is night. But then, the last line here. V'aksiv tzar ta'aseh la'teva. The Talmud asks, what are you talking about? But it says, you shall make a tzohar for the boat. The assumption that this passage makes is that tzohar means window. And therefore they ask, what do you mean he had a gem? The Torah says he should use a tzohar. And they answer, yes, but kimanda amar lo shimshu hamazalos bishnas hamabul. This is within the view that the constellations did not serve during the year of the flood, meaning that the movement of the spheres themselves comes to a halt.
Sun and moon.
Sun and moon for our purposes, correct. There's neither daylight nor starlight, nothing that he can work with in order to have light, and therefore the gem is necessary. And this is the last piece, I think, that fuels the idea that Sohar is a gem, because you don't have daylight to work with. So therefore, you need this gem's light. Where do they get the idea that the constellations aren't functioning? That was back in source number 3, when we said, day and night shall not cease post-flood, because during the flood, they ceased. You follow? That's the idea. That's what's fueling our Medrash. So our Medrash wants to know what Noach used. What was his tzohar? And for four different reasons, our Medrash says, or at least Rabbi Levi says in our Medrash, it was a gem. Number one, logically, because of the rain. Number two, because of the verb, you shall make a tzohar, suggests putting something artificial in place. Number three, because this is a tzohar, it's not called a chalon, which is the word the Torah uses for window. And number four, because they're suggesting there is no light coming in from the outside, and therefore this gem is needed. Clear? Now this medrash is unlike pretty much every other medrash we've seen this year, in the sense that it doesn't provide a clear moral of the story. In every medrash we've looked at, we've taken away something beyond the simple question of how do I read the biblical text, what is this text saying, to learn all sorts of wonderful lessons about life in general. So last week, we talked about why the Torah mentions the dimensions of the boat, right? And aside from the practical lesson that we learned about if you're building a ship, this is a good ratio from for the beam of your boat, right? Aside from that, we also had a nice discussion about whether the Torah comes to teach me more than just my relationship with God, but also how to get along in this world. Or we saw the vav when it said v'zeh asher ta'aseh ota. And this is how you should make it, and we linked it with Divrei Hayamim to show that the amma that Noach uses, the cubit measure that Noach uses for the boat, is the same as the measure used for the building of the Beit HaMikdash of the temple, and as a message to Noach that what you do in fulfilling my command to build this boat is as important as building a temple to me. Like there are all sorts of nice messages. I don't know what to do with this message here, with this medrash about what Noach used for illumination. I don't think it's necessarily coming to teach me a nice moral lesson. I think that sometimes the medrash really is just, here's a biblical word, and here's how to explain it. It can be that simple. However, nonetheless, I think there is a lesson we can superimpose on this medrash, even though the medrash is not saying it. I think that there is an important lesson that we can add to this, based on what Rabbeinu Bechaye does as he continues his comment on the Tzohar in source number 11. Remember that I told you that the Tzohar is the same as the third gem
on the Kohen Gadol's breastplate, the Bereket stone. Correct. Which tribe, given that all of the stones correspond to a tribe, which tribe is the tribe that will have the third stone?
Judah.
Levi. Levi. Levi counts for this. Levi isn't in the census on other things, in which case Judah is in fact the third, but for this purpose Levi is there. And Ephraim and Manasseh become one with Yosef, presumably, but there's discussion about that. But in any case, Levi will be the third, the bearer of the third stone. What is the role of Levi?
Transmit.
To transmit Torah, to transmit tradition, to teach, right? They're the ones who maintain the purity of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle. They're the ones who work there. They take a look at source number 11, what Rabbeinu Bachaye does with this. He says, Unisana lelevi. God assigned this stone to Levi. Mipnei sheshevet Levi hayu meirin b'Torah, because the tribe of Levi illuminates with Torah. By the way, he does for each of the stones. He explains why each stone is appropriate for each tribe. So the gemologists among us might be interested in reading more about Rabbeinu Bachaye's commentary on this. But you can have a whole new field, right? They have the gemstones for people's birth, like you have your birthstone, and you can have your tribe stone also. It's a whole new moneymaker. Omni Jewelers is calling. He assigned it to Levi because the tribe of Levi illuminates with Torah. Ke'inyan shenamar, as in fact we are told in Devarim, in Deuteronomy, Yoru mishpatach le'Yaakov b'saraskal Yisrael. Moshe says for the tribe of Levi, when he gives his final blessing for the Shevet, for the tribe, they, Levi, will teach your statutes to Yaakov, to Jacob, and your Torah to Israel. V'chein Moshe shehayam mishevet Levi. And so to Moshe, Moses, he was from the tribe of Levi, and we are told, kishenolad nismalei kol habayis ora, that when Moshe was born, the house was filled with light. That's because the biblical text says, when Moshe is born, v'tera oso kitohu, that she, his mother, saw that Noah, that Moshe was good. And the question is, of course, what does it mean to see that Moshe is good? All babies are good. She saw that Moshe was good, and so the Medrash there says that it means the house was filled with light, and therefore it's another association for us of light and Levi. V'ne'amar bo, and it also says ki karan or panav, that Moshe's face shone after he communicated with God. Uchsiv chochmas adam tahir panav. And then another verse from Kohelet, from Ecclesiastes, a person's wisdom illuminates his face. So that what Rabbeinu Bachaye develops is the idea that this stone that Noach is using in the boat is associated with the light, not just physical light, but also spiritual illumination. That would be his idea, because it's the light, it's the stone that Levi uses on the Choshen. Ralph, you were going to say something?
A chalon does not retain light.
Right.
But a zohar does retain light.
Depending on which of the types of light we talked about.
Yes. And presumably the Jewish people would be compared to a zohar and not a chalon.
So this is where I wanted to go. Excellent. We are now at the final stage. We are superimposing a moral lesson on a medrash that really had no interest in it. But we do.
That's the sense of
yes.
Absolutely.
I think Rabbeinu Bachaye intends it. Absolutely. Comparing the Zohar to Torah actually works whether it is a gem or it is a window. Because Torah can be either one. Right? When someone studies Torah, either the Torah provides its own light, or it magnifies what is already there, and that can be for good or for otherwise. So we are taught, for example, the Talmud asks how it is that Doeg, who is the general of Shaul HaMelech, of King Saul, how it is that he could have become corrupt. And he's supposed to be this brilliant sage and so on. And their answer is, the Torah was always superficial. It didn't get inside. And that is used also to explain the actions of various other figures within Tanakh. But more germane is actually a separate metaphor for Torah. Torah is often compared to water. Moshe says to the Jews towards the end of Deuteronomy, Ya'arof kamatar likhi. My lessons should fall like rain.
Vilna Gaon comments on that and says, you know, rain helps the seeds grow, whatever seeds happen to be there. Those could be seeds for poison ivy. Those could be weeds. Or they could be roses. It's really whatever you plant. The Torah is going to enhance that which is already present within the person. Which is why we are taught you're not supposed to teach Torah to somebody if they're going to misuse it. Because Torah will amplify whatever's already present there. So we could look at Zohar, you know, one way or the other. But by placing Torah as the Zohar within the boat, we're saying that this experience on the boat, living beneath the light of the Zohar, can be one of two things. It can be transformative, or it can be just another event in the lives of those on board. It's up to them to determine whether they're going to emerge the same as they entered, or whether they're going to become something new. And when you look at it in terms of this this idea of comparing the Zohar to the Torah, I think that's it's an interesting point that Rabbeinu Bachaye has added. He's really brought another dimension to the conversation. But to sum up what we've said, the message of our Medrash is fundamentally that this word Zohar is strange. It's unusual, and it's more unusual because the Torah is fully capable of using the word Chalon when it wants to describe the window in Noach's boat. So the Medrash is using the Medrash of saying that by default, Zohar is a window, like the Yerushalmi wants to say. But the question of logic, is Noah really using a window on this boat? Number one. And the question of language, of the verb, ta'aseh, you shall make this. Of the fact that it used Zohar instead of Chalon. Of the fact that you have this pasuk that indicates that day and night don't exist during the flood. All of that leads Rabbi Levi to say, you know what, maybe it's not a window at all. It's this other source of light. And that, to me, is the way to understand this Medrash. Ralph?
Is it not true that Noah was not transformed by the experience?
Well, he's definitely transformed by the experience. The only question is it a good or bad transformation?
Afterwards, he gets drunk and...
So that may be a bad transformation. In other words, we don't find any hint of that sort of thing beforehand. We only find it post-flood. I mean, if anyone's ever been a candidate for PTSD, right, post-traumatic stress disorder, it's Noach. That's not a joke. I mean, can you imagine the burden of that? And survivor guilt along with it, absolutely.
But at least afterwards, he recognized what his children had done. It wasn't, and he punished the ill-doer.
Right, which is important because pre-flood there's no justice whatsoever. I'm number one, I believe very strongly that engaging in amateur diagnosis of people who lived centuries and of whose lives we have two or three stories is foolish. I'm certainly not about to diagnose Noach. We are, on the other hand, responsible to learn from the stories the Torah gives us. If the Torah tells the story, it means for us to learn lessons from it, and we do look at the story and say, what happened to this man? But I think it's also a lot more complex. This year we are not getting to what happens after the flood. We'll be lucky if we see any rain. But it's something that's definitely worth further discussion in terms of, is this a transformative experience for Noah, and is it a transformative experience for his kids, about whom we know, really, if we know little about Noah, we know nothing about the kids. It's certainly pre-flood. Pre-flood, we know they exist. That's basically it. So there's more to be said on that front. So I told you that if we finished this Medrash, we would do something about the Haggadah, and I gave you the sheets. So just very quickly, a fast thought, which we're not going to be able to do full justice for, but you know, we have 10 minutes. Let's use it. This is an idea which first hit me last year about a section of the Haggadah that troubled me for years and years, and I never really got it. And then last year, I was able to put something together based on a comment that the Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, makes on the body of Medrash called Mechilta. And very quickly, you have all the sources in front of you. I will not read through them inside, just in the interests of time. But towards the end of the Maggid, as some people may be wandering into the kitchen to check on the food, and some people are wishing they could wander into the kitchen to check on the food, and people are thinking, all right, enough already, let me get to the food. You get to the math portion of the Haggadah, right? in which we are told that every plague that struck the Egyptians was really four plagues or five plagues, and they had 200 plagues of the sea or 250 plagues of the sea. And I don't know what in the world you're talking about. What does this math game mean? Who cares how many there are? And where did you get your numbers from? And yes, there's a way to calculate it, but it's very hard to understand. And it's hard to understand what in the world this is doing in our Haggadah. Not to mention, the Rambam doesn't have it in his Haggadah. You know what else the Rambam doesn't have in his Haggadah? He doesn't have Dayenu. I don't know what they sang. There's no Dayenu in the Rambam's Haggadah. Dayenu existed in his day. We have it in Haggadahs that are earlier than his, in Sephardic lands. So why doesn't he have Dayenu? Why doesn't he have this? So to make a long story short, because I've given this shiur as a 45-minute to an hour shiur, it ain't going to be right now. But to make a long story short, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin points out something fascinating within this. If you flip to the second side, number seven. No, that's not the one I want. But thank you. You're not going to go number four on the bottom of the first side. This is a good, quick example. The Medrash in Shmos Rabbah, talking about what happens at the sea and the way that they all suffer 200 plagues, 250 plagues, whatever it is, caps off the discussion by quoting a verse from Tehillim, from Psalms, in which we are told, Noda Hashem Mishpat Asa. God is known, He has performed justice. And this is the way that the Medrash introduces what we have in our Haggadah, which is in source number 2, about the 200 and 250 plagues. What happens is a form of justice. What is the justice? So the Nitziv writes, it's in source number 3, that people at the sea experience different things in the water based on what they had done to the Jews in Egypt. Those who were horribly cruel to the Jews suffer miserably in the water. Those who were better to the Jews suffer less in the water. And that's an idea you've probably seen or heard referenced at some point in relation to the song the Jews sing after the Egyptians drown, right? In Az Yashir. Because there we are told, on the one hand, that they sank like lead, but we're also told they sank like stone, but we're also told they're thrown about like straw. Which is it? So if you flip the page, you find another medrash in source number 5, in which we are told that it depended on who they were. Those who were better to us had one treatment. Those who were harsher to us had a different treatment. There's a lot to discuss about number 5 in particular, but it's totally beyond the scope of where we're going to get today. But the point is that the Nitziv suggests, flipping you back to source number 3, the Nitziv suggests each of the pursuers of Israel met an unusual death, which is why he points out at Mariv, in the evening service, there's a blessing which notes, Esrod Fehem v'es Sonehem bishamos tiba, that God drowned the Rodfim and the Sonim. A Rodef is a pursuer. A Sone is an enemy. Why do we characterize Egyptians as pursuers and enemies? Suggests Rabbi Berlin in his commentary, because some of the Egyptians pursued us because they hated us, and some of them pursued us because it was their job. They were in the Pharaoh's military, and they showed up one morning and they were told, today we're going to clean out the stables, and they showed up another day and they were told, today we're going to pursue the Jews. And they went and did it, and we don't excuse them for it. They get punished for doing it. Saying I was just doing my job is not an adequate defense. But it's not as bad as the person who volunteered. The person who said, I want to go out and do this. And that person suffers, in fact, a different fate. And so what the Nitziv suggests is that each of the plagues that occur at the sea, when we say that each plague was four plagues or five plagues, what we're saying is that God struck each one in kind. Each event that took place was different for different people to strike them measure for measure. Which he uses to explain an interesting anomaly in the verses that lead up to Az Yashir. The verses that lead up to, I'm sorry, yeah, that lead up to Az Yashir, to the song the Jews sang at the sea. The verses that lead up to it say that the Jews saw the mighty hand God had brought against the Egyptians. And then they trusted in God, excuse me, they were, it says they feared God. The word in the Hebrew is vayira'u, which can mean fear or reverence, but in context then it takes that one as fear. They feared God, and then they trusted in God and in Moshe his servant. So the Nitziv asks a series of questions. He says, number one, why not say that the Jews saw what God had done for the Jews, and that caused them to believe? Why are they motivated by seeing what God did to the Egyptians? How about the fact that he split the sea and brought us through on dry land? That should count for something. That's number one. Number two, he says, if what you saw is that God destroyed your enemies, why did that make you afraid? That should have made you feel pretty good. You have a pretty good defender there. And number three, why is it that they only believe now? They saw 10 plagues in Egypt. They saw fire and ice coming down from the sky at the same time. That they didn't believe in. This they're going to believe in. Why now do they believe? And so Rabbi Berlin suggests, and that's the part that's in source number 7, but I'm not going to read it aloud. You can see it there. He says that the idea is not that they're impressed by the might of what happens at the sea. They saw divine might already back in Egypt. What they're impressed by is the measure for measure. Because it says to them that God is watching what goes on in this world, and counter to what we see on a day-to-day basis in our own existence, there is some form of justice. And the one who you know, your Egyptian neighbor, the guy down the block, or whether he's your neighbor or not, but the guy who whipped people, suffered in this way. The guy who enslaved people but didn't whip them, suffered in a more benign way. Did not have to go through the same thing. And he says that is what they see here that they didn't see in Egypt, number one. Number two, it's why it says that they were impressed by what God did to the Egyptians. That's what impresses them. And number three, it's why they're then afraid. Because once you recognize that there's a God who's watching what everybody does, you start to think, uh-oh, well, what has God been watching of what I did? It's not necessarily a happy thought. When we learned Treyasar in previous years, we saw several prophets who said, beware, you know, you think you're praying for a wonderful day of Mashiach, and things are going to be great, and everyone's going to get lollipops. It doesn't always work that way. As far as Maimonides omitting this, so to make a long story short, Maimonides seems to believe, and it's based on source number 9, or Herschel Schechter is the one who points this out. Maimonides believes that the purpose of the Seder is to talk about what happens on the night of the 15th of Nisan, the night we get out. Because that's what we're told to speak about in the biblical verse in source number 10. Talk about what I did to Egypt. And that's what we do. We talk about the events of that night. So therefore Maimonides leaves out this, because this is about what happened at the sea. And he leaves out Dayenu, because 3/4 of Dayenu is about after we leave Egypt, giving us the man in the wilderness, right? Bringing us to High Sinai, giving us the Torah, giving us Shabbos, bringing us to Israel, building a temple. Those are all posts. So therefore Maimonides says, that's a great song, but it doesn't belong at your Seder. Whereas the justification for including it now may be, because this actually completes a really good arc. The first mention in the Torah of the Jews going down to Egypt is when? Sorry?
You want to say Bidinshar?
Yeah. When God speaks to Abraham and says, your children will be strangers in a land not their own. Vavadum binu osamar bameyos shana. They're going to be made to work for 400 years. V'gamas hagoy asher ya'avodu dan anochi. But I'm going to judge the nation that did this to them. Ark is now complete, because it's not judgment with the 10 plagues in Egypt. There's no direct justice. And the Medrashim point out, measure for measure, the Egyptians did this, and therefore this happened to them. There is something, but the true measure for measure is what happens at the sea. That's what completes the Ark. Yeah?
It completes the Ark, but it's also, I mean, the argument we have, like, we don't call me Rosh Chodesh. I mean, I assume Rambam said that, but his point is, no, we're only focusing on what happened that night.
But Yochel Rosh Chodesh is only to prepare for that night. It's about telling the story of, telling the laws, I should say, of. So my last point on this, really, I'm going to leave hanging here, because I don't have a good answer for it. I believe this is an important part of our Seder, as part of the Higadat HaLevincha, the mitzvah of telling our children about what happened in Egypt. So part of telling them is telling them that there was this shining moment in time when God actually punished the bad guys and saved the good guys. Whatever you see around you, the chaos that we perceive in the world around us, there are moments like this at which you can actually witness a divine hand, and you can see incredible things in this world. And that's a very important piece of what we convey to our children. It's not just about what happened when our nation was formed, although that's important, but it's also about our experience in the world today. The part that I'm going to leave you hanging with, because I don't have a good answer, is do we really have to tell our children this through a negative? Through the punishment of the Egyptians? Wouldn't it be really great if we could convey to them this message that sometimes you see the divine hand through good things happening to good people as opposed to bad things happening to bad people? And the only answer I have for it is, unfortunately, we don't have a record of a particular moment in time of good things happening to good people that we can use as a great example. But that's not a satisfying answer for me. And so that's something that I leave you with to think about. Have a wonderful Pesach.